today mostly we'll be talking about the theologian Thomas Berry, and but let me put him in a little bit of context from the point of view, sort of the flow of events of this class. When I had you read Joseph Campbell, he wrote a lot about what he called the hero's journey. And the hero's journey, as Campbell describes it, is something that you find in all religions, as a mythic structure. You find it in all religions. And the essentials of the hero's journey, he outlines, but a kind of a key point is that the hero goes off, goes through various experiences, goes off away from conventional society, the conventional world, goes through various experiences, usually trials and tribulations of some sort, changes in the process, accomplishes something, gains something, or wins some prize or some talisman or something like that. But then the important thing is that the hero comes back to the conventional world and fulfills some role. And generally the role that the hero fulfills in the conventional world is to reinvigorate the society, culture, village, or what have you that the hero came from. Now the story is described as a hero's journey, but it can also be a heroine's journey. And one of the things that's nice about the Wizard of Oz story, which is a hero's journey, is that it's a heroine's journey, right? It's not a hero's journey, it's a heroine's journey. So how does that relate to where we are right now? Well, for one thing, if we jump back to Whitmont was telling us that what's conscious in a society and what's unconscious in a society are discrepant, right? So if the general story or myth that's operative in a society is about the hero's journey, then what's developing in that society or that culture is something else, which is different than the hero's journey. It may be a different kind of hero's journey, but it's not like the conscious hero's journey. Okay, so that's the first thing. If we go back to the story of the Buddha that we looked at, the Buddhist story is a hero's journey. The Buddha goes off, he meditates, he has a realization of something, he comes back to the world and he shows people how to free themselves from suffering. After the time of the Buddha, many other Buddhists engaged in that kind of activity. They believed that story, and so I'm using the word story now instead of myth, because Thomas Berry talks about story. Okay, they believed that story or they believed that myth, and they engaged in that themselves. They leave home, they go follow the Buddhist path, live in a monastery, whatever the case may be. And if they would have some realization, then they would come back often as teachers, healers for their culture generally, wise old men, you know, the grandfather or uncle you wish you always had that would tell you how to deal with the world but probably you didn't have, or whatever the case may be. Okay. So that was the hero's journey. And that kind of story was operative in Asia for many years, and versions of it were operative in the West for many years. For example, in the Middle Ages, we had the story of the knights who would be questing after the Grail or something like that. Okay. Now, these are spiritual stories. They're embedded in religion, because if you look at the Grail quest, it's very embedded in the medieval view of Christianity. It's not separate from it. It's embedded in it. And obviously, the same thing for the Bodhisattva path. That's the path, the route that Buddhas to be follow, people who want to become Buddhas, both men and women, even though I say Buddhas, because Buddha is non-gender, would follow this path. Whitmont reminds us that something else is going to be going on, because that's what's going on consciously. But what's happening unconsciously? What's happening in the collective and individual minds if there comes a time when that story is not working so well? I mean, the Grail myth, for example. Can anybody here imagine themselves going off on a quest to find the Grail? And the Grail is essentially the cup that Jesus passed around at the Last Supper. That's one of the ways of understanding the Grail. No, I mean, can anybody imagine doing that? No. But on the other hand, we can all imagine getting a college degree and going out and making a living in a certain way, either one kind of profession or one kind of life of some sort with a certain set of skills and talents, and achieving whatever we want in the world, family, a certain kind of home or Ferrari, I mean, whatever the case may be, you know, that's the quest. That is the quest. We still are questing after something. Now, we don't necessarily imagine we're going to come back to the world. We're going to drive back to Le Grand in your Ferrari and say, hey, folks, this is the way. You know, we don't imagine that sort of thing. But there is this residue of this spiritual idea of the quest that's operative in all of our minds. If it wasn't there, it would be very hard to put up with a lot of the challenges that are in our life. Like, it'd be hard to put up with college if you didn't think there was some sort of goal out there that you were going to achieve. Now, the practicality of achieving the goal of a college education and questing after the grail may look very different, but at the emotional level, not on the literal practical level, but on the emotional level, they may not be all that different, actually. And it's kind of interesting to investigate that. Now, if we come to Thomas Berry, Berry was influenced very strongly by a Catholic theologian, actually a Jesuit by the name of Teilhard de Chardin, and I've written his name down here. Teilhard was actually a scientist. He was a very important paleontologist. If you've ever heard of Peking Man, or Beijing Man would be the way it's pronounced now, one of the earliest forms of human that's been excavated was, he was involved in the excavation that found Peking Man, or Beijing Man. So he was actually a scientist, but he was a Jesuit priest. But he also wrote theology, which was suppressed by the Catholic Church. And the reason his theology was suppressed by the Catholic Church was he had this idea that the evolutionary process was actually going someplace, that it wasn't just sort of like the randomness of events coming together, survival of the fittest, what have you, which is the general theology, sorry, not the general theology, the general scientific view. He thought that the world was evolving, that life was evolving, that humans were evolving towards some point, which had to do with Christian theology and reuniting with Christ and this kind of thing. The point is, he built evolution into a theology. This is before there was any kind of intelligent design theology floating around or anything like that. Anyhow, the church didn't like his ideas for a number of reasons and suppressed it. So Teilhard is very interesting because he proposed that idea. Now, Thomas Berry follows him but has a somewhat different idea. And I hope you read his article. I know it's a bit difficult, but he has some very interesting ideas. He doesn't just talk about evolution. He talks about what he calls the Earth story, right? And when he talks about the Earth story, he's saying something about evolution, but he's talking about the whole development of the Earth right up through human beings, and that human beings have a special place and responsibility in this process, because human beings are self-conscious. Other animals are conscious, but human beings are self-conscious. Other animals are not. This is the theological position. Okay. And because of that, there's something unique about human beings. And the uniqueness about human beings is that they're self-conscious of, or can be self-conscious of, the Earth story or the evolutionary story, which created their own self-consciousness. Okay. So that's something very unique about human beings. And that creates a kind of unique responsibility that human beings have. So how does this relate to the hero's journey or the bodhisattva path? Well, the way it relates is Berry says that the current story that's operative in our society is not working, and that's why our society is failing. And when I say society, I mean the whole of Western culture. I don't just mean American society. Maybe I should say Western culture. In fact, he means planetary culture, but he doesn't say that. The story is failing, and we'll talk about why the story is failing. He says we need a new story to make things work around here, which is to say we need a new myth. Whitmont would say it was the Grail myth. Berry would disagree with that and frankly, I would disagree with that too. We need a new myth. We need a new story to explain what's going on for us here, to put ourselves in a theological, spiritual, religious context, to revivify the different religions of the world, in fact, he would say. And he gets very specific about Christianity. The new story, he says, is the story of the earth. It's not just evolution, and it's not necessarily intelligent design. It's something else. And one of the things that it is we don't know what it is entirely because it hasn't told itself to us. It's unfolding. But part of what it is conscious evolution, which is to say the responsibility of human beings as having become self-conscious and becoming self-conscious to include the world story is to understand that their personal development, so now we get back to Wittmann and so on and so forth, that their personal development in expanding their own consciousness and becoming complete is part of the earth story. Not only that, it's the way the earth will self-regulate through human beings. Now, I kind of disagree with that idea myself, but anyhow, that's Barry's idea. That the self-consciousness of humanity is required now for the earth to self-regulate. There are people who believe this. I saw a TED talk recently, which was some scientist had gotten enough money to equip an airplane to fly over the forests of the Amazon and to map them in a unique way where he could see how individual trees in 3D were growing and developing and get a whole different sense of the nature of the forest than you could get by either being on the ground or sensing from outer space. And he said something very interesting. He said, "We need this information because the world has gotten to this place where it doesn't manage itself anymore. We have to manage it." Now, personally, I think that that's insane. I don't think the collective human mind is capable of managing the planet. But this is Barry's point of view. I think it's more likely that we can say that the Earth process, as expressing itself in human self-consciousness, is asking something of us. And one thing it's asking of us is that we become whole, and that following that path to wholeness is the new hero's journey. That's the new bodhisattva path. Becoming whole, becoming self-conscious, resolving the internal splits of Apollo and Dionysus, male and female. All those repressed elements need to be resolved in order to become whole. And why is this important from a theological point of view? It's important from a theological point of view because if we're not whole, what we're constantly doing is projecting our broken confusion into the world around us, and we can't do a good job in our relationships with each other or in our relationships with the world. And from an ecological perspective, that would be even the most important thing. Now think about this for a minute. Right now in Japan, there's a seriously damaged set of nuclear reactors in Fukushima, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactors. They are spilling radioactive cesium, iodine, and all kinds of other nucleotides into the Pacific Ocean at an astonishing rate. This is serious bad news. Okay. One of the reasons there's such a problem with nuclear energy is that the designers of nuclear power plants, like the designers of the atomic bomb and everything else, never stopped to think about what they had to do with their waste products. What do you do with the uranium when it's spent? Oh, we'll just stick it in the ground someplace, right? So you go up to Hanford and you find out what are the consequences of just sticking it in the ground, right? The entire aquifer in Hanford is polluted with nuclear waste and it's starting to leach into the Columbia River, which means that it becomes a hazard to everything down the Columbia River from Hanford, including what? Portland, the entire Pacific Ocean. Now, what kind of mentality would say we don't have to think about waste products? A broken mentality, a distorted mentality, a mentality that doesn't understand entire cycles, right? So the point of becoming whole is if you become whole, you can see whole processes. if you can see whole processes, you don't do stupid things like building nuclear power plants over underground rivers next to oceans that are subject to earthquakes, typhoons, and other obvious natural disasters. In fact, the first nuclear reactor at Fukushima was built by General Electric through a turnkey process. That means the Japanese hired General Electric, paid him a certain amount of money, and GE just built the plant. A whole group of engineers resigned from GE rather than build that plant. They said, this is remarkably stupid to build this plant in this location. Don't do it. They weren't listened to. All they could do was resign. They couldn't make it stop, but they wouldn't participate in it. Right? Okay. So we're entering a time where, according to Barry, the Earth is asking us to participate consciously in its evolutionary process and to manage it consciously. According to Barry, this is also a religious activity. Why is it a religious activity? It's a religious activity because if we don't become whole, if we don't reinvigorate our internal spiritual life with the new story that he's talking about, there's no possibility of our doing this successfully. Too cold? Go ahead and close that if it's too cold. I don't want anybody getting sicker than is likely to be sick already, but it's pretty hot and stuffy in here. Okay, so that's the context that I want to place Barry in, okay? Because I want you to see Barry in the larger flow of this whole course, where we've talked about the quest, now we can use that word, the quest for wholeness, where we've talked about evolutionary process, where we've talked about myth, where we've talked about resolving splits like the Apollonian-Dionysian split, becoming whole in the way in which Whitmont would talk about merging magical, mythic, and mental minds in ourselves. Okay, this is all the human responsibility, the human spiritual path, the human spiritual responsibility, according to these thinkers. And the other thing about this is it's global, right? Barry tells the story as a sort of Christian story, if you will, and I'll bring out some passages in Barry shortly. But the story is not just a Christian story. It's broader than that, and it implicates the whole world. And in fact, it has implications for where we began this class, which was pluralism and issues of pluralism. And why is that? One of the things that Barry says, perhaps I can even find a specific quotation if you give me a minute here, says, this is on page 128, thus, a new creation story has evolved from the secular scientific community, equivalent in our times to the creation stories of antiquity. This creation story, which is the new story based on science and theology coming together, this creation story differs from the traditional Eurasian creation stories much more than those traditional stories differ from one another. This new creation story seems destined to become the universal story taught to every child who receives formal education in the modern world, who receives formal education in its modern form anywhere in the world. So think about it. Isn't it true that in the world, if you become educated at the college level, you study science. The scientific worldview is the worldview that you end up adopting. It doesn't matter if you're going to high school in Hong Kong, Beijing, Delhi, Riyadh might be an exception, Rome, London, New York, or Le Grand, Bogota, doesn't make any difference. If you get educated, you learn a basic scientific worldview. And even if you don't get educated, you're meshed in a basic scientific view of the world. All right? So the new story that everybody shares is science. But Barry points out that historically in the West, what happened after the Black Death was there was a kind of a bifurcation, a division, where some folks continued to embrace religion, and he describes it as redemptive religion, but other folks took a scientific point of view. Before the Black Death, there was a way in which an interest in the natural world and an interest in religion came together. Okay. After the Black Death, he says, there was a division in the Western world. Not causal. This is not causal. But there was a division. And science arises on the one hand, and theology continues on the other hand. But religious life and theology becomes more about redemption. If you go to church in the United States now, mostly what you hear about is Jesus, Jesus as your Savior, and you hear about redemption. But what you don't hear about, you don't hear about much about the creation of the world and the world as a sacred space because it was created by God. Now, in some churches you will hear this, but it's not the standard story that you hear in church. It used to be the standard story that you heard in church before the Black Death, according to Barry. You know, the way people understood the world they were in was it was God's creation. It was not separate from God in some fundamental way. It was separate in the sense that God created it and stood back from it, but God still created it. That's all gone now, right? So we live in a world dominated by science, but it's a world dominated by science in which the world has no value of itself. The only value of the world is what we can take out of it. If the world had value in itself, we wouldn't have Fukushima's. No culture would have allowed this kind of way of treating the world if the world was understood as being sacred, created by God, something like that. We have an instrumental view of the world because science has no spiritual values. That's what Barry is telling us. And yet at the same time, science is the story that all children all over the globe are going to be told. So one of the ways of addressing the need for a pluralistic religious vision in the world, which is probably the only way you're going to have anything like peace in the world, okay, is to look at what do we on the planet share? What do we have in common? Not just what do we have as difference. Now, not to eradicate the differences, you know, Allah, Buddha, nature, God the Father, whether they're the same or not is irrelevant, right? What do we share? What do we have in common? Barry would say it's the story of the earth that we have in common. Not just science, but science resacralized. That's the argument he's making, that science can be resacralized. Yeah. Science can be resacralized. And since science is the story, since the scientific view of the development of the earth and humanity is a story that all people on the planet will have in common in the 21st century, this seems clear. If that story can be resacralized, then there is a spiritual, religious, sacred story that everybody on the planet could have in common. That's really what Barry is saying. And that's relevant to the problems of religious pluralism, right? Because if people in this country and people in Japan and people in China and people in India could find something to agree upon on a religious, cultural level, and let's set economics aside for the moment, which is another kind of problem, but I'll get to it, okay? Find something to agree upon, a lot of the problems that humans create for themselves in the world could be resolved. But it's not just a materialistic scientific story that's required, because we've already got that. That gave us Fukushima, right? It's a spiritualized story. And Barry is saying that the Earth story, not just evolution, but the Earth story is a spiritualized story. Why is it spiritualized? Because it involves conscious evolution. It involves the idea that there is a process which creates human beings who consciously participate in the evolutionary developmental process. And that consciousness, that self-consciousness, is fundamentally spiritual in nature. And why is it fundamentally spiritual in nature? Because it's a quest for wholeness. Because it's a quest for wholeness and integration of the whole human being, it's spiritual in nature. So do you see how all the pieces of this story I've been telling you in this class at this point start to fit together, right, and loop back to the idea of pluralism? And so the key piece that we needed to get to was Barry, and we needed to see Barry and the Earth story in this larger context. Because if you just read Barry on his own, you might say, well, that's interesting, that's inspirational, maybe I agree with this part, I don't agree with that part, and so on and so forth. But I wanted to create a picture, a story, a pattern that was larger and that incorporated Barry in a way that would also create a mechanism for understanding what does religion do. Because if we go back to what is this class is about what is religion. It's an introduction to religion. It's an introduction to what is religion. So you can look at what is religion from the point of view of, you go down to the church down the street, and this is the theology of the church. You can look at religion as you go down the street, and the theology of the church is redemptive, it's creative, it's Christian, or it's not. People get along with each other or they don't. You know, what are the sociological aspects of going to church? What are the anthropological aspects of going to church? That can all be part of the study of religion, but the study of religion can also be, how does religion inform our experience? And what does religion say about our responsibility as human beings on a personal level in terms of our own life and from the point of view of social responsibility? So finally, the other thing I was going to do was I was going to talk about economics, right? Because one of the things that we know is going on in the world is there's a shift in wealth, right? I mean, all the time these days you hear about wealth flowing to the 1% of the population of this country and away from everybody else, how the middle class is disappearing, how that's eroding jobs for college graduates and all of these kinds of things. All this stuff is true. I'm not downplaying any of this stuff. But if you think about what's happening in a certain point of view, what's happening is you have elites who are, for their own benefit, acquiring as much wealth as possible. So, I went to high school with a guy by the name of Michael. We used to play with little cars in the sand together when we were children. As he got older, he went off and studied finance, and he invented something after he came out of Wharton School of Business called the junk bond. This guy's name was Michael Milken. Okay. Very interesting fellow. Brilliant when he was in high school, but he and I obviously had very different paths and interests. Eventually, probably because he irritated the wrong people, he got busted for corrupt dealings in the stock market and finance and so on and so forth. When he was busted, he was fined $1 billion and sent to jail for 2 years. He was fined $1 billion, 1980s dollars, not 2013 dollars, but $1 billion, 1982 dollars. Poor soul, he only had $1.5 billion left after being fined $1 billion. I could never, now so I knew this guy, right? For the life of me, I could never figure out why it was that having $100 million wasn't enough. That he had to have $2 billion and $3 billion and more and more and more. I could never figure it out. In fact, if he'd stopped at $100 million, which seems to me like an adequate amount of wealth, if he'd stopped at $100 million, he never would have gotten busted. Okay. What happened? Why does anybody need so much money? Why does anybody need so much power and influence? What is it that people are looking for that drives them in this way? And what is it that they're missing in their relationship with the rest of the world that they don't care? How can Bernie Madoff rip off everybody right and left with the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time? And he knew what he was doing. It wasn't like he was deluded. And the people working with him knew what he was doing. It was just that the people he ripped off didn't. And that was everybody. He ripped off everybody. What are the social consequences of a financial and economic system which eviscerates the lives of entire generation of people? Us. You, me, my money disappeared. How is this impacting your future? You know, what's the job market for you? What's the cost of a college degree? Will you ever be able to own a home? Do you want to? Used to be considered that was a safe thing to do. Talk to the people whose mortgages are putting them underwater, as they say. You know, where does all this stuff come from? Right? In a world of social responsibility, in a sacred world, this kind of thing wouldn't happen. Right? I mean, other things happen. I'm not saying that bringing about a new kind of morality that's based upon sort of a sacred idea of the world we live in solves all problems. Native Americans had a view that the world was sacred. And they were tribal. And, you know, the Blackfeet really liked killing the crow. I mean, this is a bit, they thought it was a great thing to do, you know. And I don't mean crows flying around in the sky. I mean Crow Indians, you know. I mean, tribal societies were brutal with each other, absolutely brutal with each other, insiders, outsiders, and so on and so forth. But from an earth process evolutionary point of view, we don't have to be tribal anymore. So does that mean all problems will be solved? No, but certain problems probably will be solved. Okay. I think that's probably enough for the moment about Thomas Berry. Okay. He's worth reading. We're thinking about the earth process as a new story, a new myth, and that's the point, which would inform the meaning of our lives, and that's what he's really trying to share with us. And transform religion, and transform the need for religion and our understanding of what religion's about and what religion can do and why it matters. Okay? So that was a lot. All right. I'll get off my soapbox now.